Had enough of the been there, done that ideas? Tired of too much talk and so little action? Rewind now and welcome to Transformation and Change Radio with Dr. Kathy Obair, where the vision of true equity, inclusion, courage, and purpose meet powerfully. Dr. Kathy delivers with dynamic, engaging conversation and the most authentically brave dialogue on air today. This hit show will challenge you to explore current issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion and deepen your capacity to choose courage to speak up to greater inclusion in everything you do. Fasten your seatbelts and accelerate your effectiveness to become a powerful change agent in your life, community, job, and society. Imagine true equity and inclusion and get the tools to really manifest your vision. No frills, no fluff, just really powerful, good stuff. Transformation and Change Radio starts now.
Welcome to Transformation and Change Radio. I'm Dr. Kathy Obair with my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Becky Martinez. This is our sixth or seventh radio show focused on understanding the dynamics of class and classism in organizations and dismantling. And we could not be more excited to have Dr. Alejandro Covarrubias, you know, Ale, who is actually our first guest, Becky reminded me, that actually was born into a family system with more class privilege, more similar to me and all of our previous guests. But that was not their experience. So we're really hoping to really dig into sort of the dynamics of class privilege at the individual level, organizational level, what we can do to disrupt them. Some of y'all may know, I can't remember when we first met, but Social Justice Training Institute is how I have you kind of in my soul. And you've moved in to be full faculty with us. And so I get to live and work with you so many times. So the three of us will be at SJTI in just a couple weeks. I can't wait, with some other folk. And then I've known you and your executive directors and your co-director roles doing significant equity, inclusion, transformational change at colleges and universities. What I'm very excited about is your just expanding your work in full-time consulting with Foundations of Hope and Justice Consulting. Wanting people to both critique and create socially just systems. The other thing that struck me in your bio, which y'all can read on the website, but grounded in the power of critical hope. Ooh, dear friend, right. Dear colleague. Mm.
Yes. And I'm excited to be here. Ollie and I were just together a few days ago and we got into some really in-depth conversations around class and our family and how it still shows up and the complexity of it. And in what I appreciate about Ale, for folks to know, is that he very much pays also attention to intersections. And so as we think about how race and class shows up, how we think about class and gender show up, how we think about race, class, and gender, how they show up. And, you know, we know that it is not siloed identities, that they're important to pay attention to individually and collectively. And so thanks, Ale, for agreeing in a very long week that we've had. And so we like to start out, we have an array of questions, and the beauty that we have in this space is we have some questions and then it's an organic conversation and one thing leads to another. And then by the next thing we know is that the hour is gone. So we want to start out with, so tell us a little bit about your class story.
Yeah. Well, first, thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting because I just love any conversation with people that I love and are friends. So my class story, grew up middle class. And make Becky, as you mentioned, the intersections of race, class, and gender for me are very, very like strong. And I would even add in religion. So grew up in a very Catholic home. Both of my parents went to college, both went to Cal State Northridge. My dad, it was a lawyer for a long time, and then became a Superior Court judge, is still currently serving as a judge in California. My mom had the privilege of being able to stay at home when we were younger, and then chose to work. And even some of my mom's narratives around work, particularly as she was getting closer to retirement. I would tease her because there was so much privilege in how she would advocate around class. And so one of the stories that my mom would often tell was she had a younger, which she deemed as a less experienced supervisor. And my mom was in her, among her office mates, was held the most class privilege. And she would often tell her supervisor, "You need me more than I need this job." And so she could always leave, but then she could speak certain truths to that supervisor that her other colleagues couldn't. So even just watching my mom navigate class, and my mom was very clear, like my husband's a judge. I'm choosing to work in this space, but then using that as a form of advocacy to push back and create hopefully more equity among her coworkers. And for me, I've always lived in those examples and watching my parents navigate class space at the intersections of race. So one of my earliest memories of class was going over to one of my tia's house. So one of my aunts, and she lived in a sort of a townhouse community, and there was a community pool. And so we spent the day swimming, and my mom bought everyone lunch, and we had a great day. And as we were leaving, I just kind of said something like, "Next time, like, you buy the lunch and we'll have the pool." And my mom's like, as we're leaving, she's like, "Don't say things like that." And I had I think I was maybe 8 or 9 years old and didn't realize the impact that could have on my tia and her family, and not because they didn't own that pool, it was a community pool. They may not have been able to always buy lunch for everybody, like my mom was able to do that. But it was in that moment, it was like hushing the class conversation. So it's like, we're not allowed to talk about class necessarily in that space, even though growing up, it was always very clear to me that close family, so my parents, my brother, my sister, and I, that we experienced class in a very different way than many of my extended family. Conversations about going to college was something that was always present in my life. Not only that I would go to college, but that my college was going to be paid for. So my parents talked to me early on. I remember in kindergarten, there was conversations about, "You're going to go to college. This is a part of your life." There was an expectation in a sense that I was to go to college. And then when I got into high school and started applying for universities, my parents sat me down and said, and it was really, I remember this coming from my dad from very, not sternly, but very clearly. He said, "We will pay for your undergraduate experience. And anything after that, we'll always pay for your books, but you have to pay the rest of it." So he's like, "It doesn't matter where, so apply where you want. Don't worry about the money. We will figure it out." And I knew that was a big deal. I knew that was generous. So at the time in my mind, it was a generous thing for my parents to do for me. As I've gotten older and had a deeper analysis around class, I realized the power that has given me in the world. I was able to buy a home in this last year and a half. I attribute part of being able to buy a home because I don't have student loans and I'm paying it off still. Right? So that literally long-standing thing that I thought was just really generous for my parents actually set me up for the rest of my life. And even then, in buying my home, my parents were able to provide me additional money to put down for the down payment, right? So those elements of class, and again, like, eternally grateful for their generosity and knowing that there is such privilege in that they have that money, that there's a generational piece they can pass on, which to me is always fascinating because my parents didn't grow up middle class or grew up maybe lower middle class. So my grandpa, my dad's dad was a carpenter. He built homes and 9 kids in the family. So my dad grew up very, like, he calls it frugal. Like, he saves everything, pays a lot of attention to like how much money he spends because of that upbringing. But also my grandpa knew to buy land. So he wasn't always investing in his own home all the time, although they had a very nice home, he was investing in properties. So when he passed away, my grandma has been able to benefit from the rent that he built some apartment buildings that comes in. And then there's like inheritance coming to the family after that because of what my grandpa did, you know, working with his hands, but also building, you know, generational wealth in many ways. You know, so I think I was able to benefit from all these things. I wasn't aware of that as a child. You know, it wasn't really a conversation that we had around how much money. I would often ask my dad, what do you do and how much do you make? And he's like, don't ask me that. Like, we don't talk about that. So money was, I never knew how much money we had or didn't have. But I knew that we could do things. Like we were able to go to like Disneyland once a year. But then our vacations, like we're also going camping. So there's this mix of, but even the fact that we're able to go on a vacation was a thing. So that sort of middle classness was often kept invisible to me. I just knew we had more than some and less than others. And then as I moved into higher education spaces, and this is where the intersection of race, gender, and class comes into play for me, was it was always assumed that I was a first generation college student. It was always assumed that I come from a working class family. And so for me to dispel that quite often was uncomfortable because it felt like I no longer belong to that Latinx community. Because to be Latinx in higher education means you're a part of this working class community as well. So it made me feel connected and disconnected at those intersections of multiple identities. And having to learn how to be comfortable with, no, this is where I come from. This is my identity. And I'm still very much a brown man in the world as I navigate the world in a middle class, and really now an upper middle class existence.
Mm. Mm. Oh my goodness, there's so much there. As your dad or your parents say, it didn't matter institutional type, go wherever you want, right? It wasn't like, you got to go to a Cal State or stay in state. And so I thank you for sharing that. I think that's the first time that I've heard you name that. In your grandmother's house being nice, right? And how we have language that's associated with class in like really indirect ways. I'm curious to know for you, especially as you think of, especially as you share around the, sometimes the tension, or the assumption, that folks hold, how does that like play out in, you know, in professional, right? In the academic settings or the settings you navigate that have education be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting. As I work with students, there's sometimes disappointment that I'm not from a working class background. And this goes to this idea of representation that we want to, like, because I look like them, right? Particularly when I work with like brown and black students, like, oh, like you look like us, like physically you look like us. But then I talk about my experience of like, oh, wait, but you're not really like us.
Yeah.
You know, and actually the way that I've, I love doing these things with both of you because then I get deeper into my own like self-awareness. And so maybe the way that I've compensated in those spaces is that I will intentionally talk about being a second generation college student. Mm. I talk about the ways in which I stand on the shoulders of my parents who paved the way for me. And I talk about how, like, and this is very authentic. So this is that I am committed to this work because of what my parents have given me. That I do want, like, I am an example of those that generate what generation set up in the future. Like I am that future generation. And I am creating, and I do my best to create more access for others and mentor my cousins and support them in the ways that I can. But yeah, so I think when I work with students, again, it's that idea of disappointment, you're not quite who we were hoping you would be. And then it's always fascinating when I work with faculty members or upper administration, as I introduce myself, and once I say that my dad's a judge, everyone perks up. There's this energy. And so it's, so and then this is where that class privilege comes in. It's like, oh, not only are, do you have a doctorate, not only are you now among the elite educated in the space, but you come from a lineage of smart people. Or you come from a like that you're generationally intelligent, deemed by our society. So I think there's something really fascinating about me or about that experience. And I always name my father and my mother because I'm so proud of them. I'm so proud to come from them and be in community with them and learn from them. And I've also seen my dad navigate class and be uncomfortable. Like my dad would much prefer to be in his backyard barbecuing and having a beer with his brothers or his sons and daughter and family than be at this really, you know, like what I would consider fancy function where he has to be, I mean, he wears a suit every day to work, but like to be in that like suit space, like he's just as comfortable in jeans and an old college t-shirt that we bring home that he's been wearing for 20 years. And I learned that from him. Like I would much rather be in community space than in the social like networking space.
I keep hearing white in my head. That's not necessarily, but I do wonder as a Latino male with class privilege, navigating mostly white people with class privilege in consulting, college, universities, just that intersection to me. And as you talked about your dad, because I, as you said, perked up, I was like, when white folks meet you and they realize, oh, doctorate, class privilege, then you're okay now. We can let you in. And so,
who is right?
What I love about you personally, as well as in this conversation, is the complexity of class privilege always balanced with the marginalization, oppression of race, and there might be others. But if you don't mind sharing a bit more, either as you've been consulting, training, being inside organizations, what are some other examples of class privilege either you've gotten, but also what's been around you? Because I think not only as both of your parents, if I track that right, said, don't talk about it. I was taught similarly, we don't talk about money, class. It's actually embarrassing. You don't, shameful to say how much money you make, even though we hold it as a badge of, oh, you're smart, you're better because you make more money, but there's still this invisibility. So I wonder if you could help me and our listeners kind of understand what are some of those dynamics of class privilege that we have to notice all the time.
Yeah. Well, even so, I'm currently making this transition out of, you know, this higher ed professional space into being a consultant. And so this is the first time that I'm going to, what I would consider is own my own business, work for myself. The way that people talk to me about owning my business, it's very different than how I see people talk to my brother who owns a barbershop about him owning his own business. So even the class piece around what is considered like, you know, this like high level consulting business versus owning a barbershop. Many of my cousins, like they're contractors. You know, many of my uncles, my godfather, my nuno has been a contractor for years. You know, my dad, before he was a judge, owned his own practice. Right. So even just the conversations around which businesses, there's that a hierarchy of which business is better, you know, who's making what is more profitable. You know, my brother makes a good living. My cousin as a contractor makes, you know, a hell of a living in what he's doing. But because I'm not laboring in the same way. I have a degree that backs up what I do. And my brother has a cosmetology degree and like even what that degree means in the world. So for me, those are the class pieces around, you know, again, like the American dream, owning a business, like that economic piece and then in which capitalism comes into all of this, that I'm seeing as this elite business, this higher end business, where my brother's barbershop may not be seen in the same way. And then thinking about, for me, that goes into then what can I charge? as I think about what is my services worth, what is my time worth, my experience, that I get to charge a certain hourly rate versus what my brother can charge for a haircut. And the skill set that my brother has, not only to cut hair, but to engage people in conversation. He mostly, being from Oxnard, it's mostly men of color, works with a lot of people who, we have a military base that's really close. So a lot of people from the military come and get haircuts with him. And so my brother's talking about politics. He's talking about, you know, men talking about their kids and how do they father. And so he's therapist, he's politician, he's community organizing, but he's not recognizing that in the same way. So people are like, I'm paying you for a haircut, when really they're paying for therapy. They're paying for some education, but can you charge that in that space? So even that, just that juxtaposition of, you know, who's credible, who's knowledgeable. I think another piece around the, so that's kind of that big world piece. I think more specific to the consulting area is, and I'm learning this, that when I'm looking at working with an organization, it's framed around organizational development, that's seen as maybe more valuable, maybe more difficult than the equity and inclusion social justice work. Mm-hmm. The equity, inclusion, social justice work, it's not, you're not expected to get paid as much or charge as much. It's supposed to be hard work and it's meaningful to you. Where org development, that's just org development. It's just part of the organization. So we should just do it, which means you can charge more for that. So even what work within the consulting world, it seems more valuable. To me, it's fascinating.
Fascinating.
That is fascinating. I never thought about it like that. So thank you for the distinctions in that. I'm curious to know how classes and like, when organizations bring you in for either one, whether it is OD work or DE&I social justice work, how or if do they engage class?
I'm noticing that issues are often rooted in class, but they code it as something else. So they code it through the lens of race if they're comfortable in doing that, or it's coded in communication. It's coded in management styles, right? So really, and this is something that I think, and Becky, as you and I talk, and I learned so much from you around class, like how we even communicate around leadership, how we communicate around the value of work. Like that's really what's embedded in most of the, and a lot of issues that are happening within organizations. So I think to me, many of the issues again are rooted in class. They're rooted in the intersections of race and class and gender in particular. But they're not coded as that because there's very little language, particularly on the organizational level around class.
Yeah, I see it talked about it, hierarchy and rank. Mm-hmm. You talked about the significant difference in how your work is valued, your business to your brother. I mean, it's so powerful. Took me right back into whether it's higher ed or nonprofits, that it's often the folks who answer the phone, that greet people who might be the advisors, who are very low paid, and yet they're doing that whole range, as you said, therapy, mm-hmm. sometimes whole person parenting, and yet they're told, you do such great work, we can't do without you, but not paid and recognized by rank, money, benefits, flexibility of schedule.
And sometimes not even invited into the professional development space. Right? As we talk about equity and inclusion, like they're still answering their phones. They're still at their desk. They might be running around supporting every logistical piece around it, but they don't actually get a benefit from that learning space that everyone else is. Right? And even, and as we talk about who is everyone else.
Yeah, well, and that's where we so clearly saw essential, right? In COVID, as we think about essential, like they did not get a day off. They, you know, grocery store workers or custodians on campus or, you know, facilities folks. They became this very, as Kathy, as you said, like distinguished, right, part of the organization, but their pay didn't change. They probably worked more than they may have even before because they were the only ones around. And what did essential really mean? Right, like let's take the code out of essential and say we need somebody on the front lines, and you're not going to get time off, right? You don't get to be safe at home working. We didn't say any of that.
And even today, as we're in this in the United States, this weird space between COVID is increasing in so many places, and yet people who are working directly with others in usually low paid, low status jobs are in still much higher risk of getting COVID or flu. And I didn't get that, Becky, till you just said that. Yeah. Classism.
Deep breath. I know that we have a couple of minutes before we're going to break. Any 1 minute zip, and then how can people connect with you, Ale, if they want to bring you in, have a conversation with you, contact you?
Yeah. So 1 minute zip.
We'll come back.
Okay. Yeah. I think one is like classes everywhere. And, you know, so really like for me, it's been developing the lens and the language to talk about class because it was intentionally made invisible for so long. And again, I think having folks like Becky and Kathy in my life where I can talk about it and work through the shame. Because I think there's so much shame built into class. I think it's practice. It's just practice. Connecting with me, you can connect. So my consulting is Foundations for Hope and Justice Consulting. You can reach me at covarrubiasconsulting.com, or you can reach out to me via email, which is AF, my last name, covarrubias@gmail.com. And I will be at NCORE in Portland in a few weeks, doing a few different presentations there, working with some colleagues around supporting chief diversity officers and developing their competency. Another session with our dear colleague, Dr. Jarrell Brooks, really looking at expanding men of color's competency around emotional labor and how do we create space both for each other as men of color and for others. And then I'll be presenting on my dissertation around really providing white women the competencies and the skills to support men of color through supervision.
What does practice look like for you? Right, practicing individually, as groups, as organizations, because that's one of the things I think is important is the action piece of it. So if you could talk with us a little bit about what does practice look like for you and what would you advise folks?
Yeah, I think, the gift of being in friendship with you, Becky, is that we practice a lot. Mm-hmm. I find myself practicing with you a lot because I know, one, that you have the lens for this work, and I trust you. I think as we were going to break, I kind of named it a little bit, there is so much shame around class. And in fact, Becky, this earlier speaker was talking about this like that, and it's the shame across class identities, similar to race, but a little bit different. So like, I think regardless of your class identity, we're socialized around having shame to talk about money. How much money do you make? How much should I ask for a raise, or can I ask for a raise? So I think for me, practice is having someone in my life that I can talk to about it, and really begin to pick apart elements of my life around where class might show up. And again, one of the gifts of learning from Becky and others is, and this is, I think, a helpful bit of practice, is expanding my lens of class beyond money. That class is so much more than just, again, how much I make or how much I don't make, How much is in my bank account? What do I own or rent? Those are great and important pieces of awareness around class, but really getting into the values below some of those things and doing some of the self-reflection around like what are basic needs? Like what does everyone deserve to have access to or like with class? I think another really important practice that on the individual level is, and again, it goes back to conversations, like as I'm engaging with friends, family members, like just trying to be mindful of like the class conversations, like the assumptions that I'm making about what people have access to, what they can do or can't do, and bringing that into the conversation, like, hey, you know, would love to get together. Should we make dinner? Do you want to go out to dinner? Where should we go? What do you have capacity for? And doing that in a way that doesn't make anyone feel bad. I think for me, it's also being mindful of the assumptions that I make as I engage with people, particularly again, this is kind of moving more into the org level, like the assumptions around what does your degree mean, your degree or title mean? Like, am I shifting how I show up with you based on your title, based on your degree? As I'm having conversations again in the consulting space, for me, what I'm really trying to get into better practice is if I get to talk to a group of folks around the work, who's in that group? So I am paying attention to title. Is it everyone with doctorates? Is it everyone who are executive directors and above, or do we have folks across the organization who have valuable input to provide? So I think that's another piece around paying attention to the hierarchy that class creates. Are we assuming that you need to have a title to give insightful feedback in the process? So I think the practice is really paying attention to who do we attribute value to and who is invisible to us.
Yeah, thank you for those nuggets. One of the things I think, even as Kathy, you did your, and you continue to do work on race, but when you did your show on race, and you know, we talk about race even here, is like have somebody that you can talk with and trust, that can be honest with and vulnerable with. And that's a really difficult thing often with class, because Ali, as you named, those feelings, right? The shame or embarrassment or guilt that's across the class spectrum, particularly on the bookends. How do we bring things up? So an example is, so Ali and I were together and I bought a lot of saltwater taffy the other day. And I told him the reason that I do this and when I go to different places, because I know that my family doesn't have that same ability to do that. And those are so small, yet so significant. And how do those show up in workplaces when we do conferencing, when we do travel, if we have to get sent out, right, to work with an organization somewhere, or how are those dynamics playing out? And how can we talk about them in like real ways that are still fun and still meaningful and hard? That for me is developing the capacity, because then your organization develops the capacity to engage in it.
And I could be wrong, so I'd like to float this idea. I find that folks in privilege by race, so white folks, if they can recognize the microaggressions, the racist daily indignities, interpersonal, that opens their heart. And they're like, oh, I don't want to be a part of that. And then, ooh, I've done that. And then they might be willing to look at the racist attitudes underneath. So I wonder if something similar, that as we're doing practice in organizations to have people tell class stories, but then bring it into what are the dynamics that actually exist in our organization, those comments, those microaggressions, who's included, kind of, you're saying you have to have a title. And I'm thinking custodian's a title, but it's not in the way that we think about title. And then have people be able to tell stories and examples. Because what I worry about is folks in our privileged identities, our hearts aren't open. We don't care enough to stay in this for the long haul. We might go to a workshop, And so part of the practice might be, how do we help people who have class privilege by growing up, by current position, to care enough to understand why they need to be collectively leading dismantling classism? So whether it's the cost of classism to the organization, to themselves, to the people they care about. So,
yeah, and I think similar to the work around race, and Kathy, I've seen you do this with white folks, is helping white folks even tell their own race story. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, again, like, that goes back to the, like, learning the language, like being able to tell my own class story as someone who grew up in the very middle class and upper middle class as my parents moved and as I moved with them. And I think arguably there's a little bit more language around race right now in the world. Mm-hmm. I think language around class is still very limited, particularly for those in privilege. I think that's part of the work. It's how do I, again, like, what, like, how do I even describe my class story? Because I think, and part of that is, there's this myth that class is relative. Mm. That it's like, oh, like relative to the people that I grew up with, I'm middle class. Relative to, like, I don't have yachts, right? I don't have a mansion. I don't have multiple homes. So I'm not really that. So I think around class, we use this sort of relative barometer to make ourselves, I have done that to make myself middle class. Mm-hmm. And to distance myself from the privilege that I actually hold. And I think that looks a little bit different than race. So I think helping folks, I know mm-hmm. I've had to learn how to do that. Like, how do I situate myself in the privilege that I hold around class and not distance myself from, like, that ultra rich group, and taking the time to reflect, I think this is where this question around, you know, what is the cost of classism? I think for many of us, class has been socialized into us in such a way that we're always aspiring to another level of class. Hmm. We're always, like, we've been taught to aspire to, like, this next level of wealth and capital, so that we never truly embrace our own class experience. And so therefore, like, we're like, it keeps us from being authentic around class. Mm-hmm. And then it also, in many ways, we end up acting politically and around, like, liberation against our own interests, because we start to vote, we start to, like, politicize in a way that's setting us up for that next class step versus the one that we're in. Right, because then so we don't actually address the system of oppression that is impacting our class identity. We've bought into the idea, like, we just gotta get to the next one and it'll be better. And there's such danger in that.
Yeah, such danger. A few things that come that popped for me. A bunch of things popped for me. So, as you think, the reference group, right? So there's Lou's social class worldview model that talks about referent groups. That we don't, not until you see a different referent group than your own, do you know what's different. And so then you start referencing other class, right? And then this hierarchy can happen. And then Hurst, right, writes about people who grew up working class that shift their class, usually because of the academy, but not always. There's like three people, right? Like there's three different spaces in that. So that's the straddler, like I've identified in the show. There is then the loyalist. So folks who don't buy into this hierarchy, that don't buy into this, I need this middle class life, who stick to their working class values. Dr. Tori Savoda, like, writes on that. And that's really her life story, right? Like, she's a professor, she's, you know, tenured faculty, but she goes back, like, outside of that, her class is very much working class. Like, that's who she's partnered with, that's who her friends are, that's who her family is. And so there isn't that taking on of that place, right? And so sometimes it can be a myth for some folks, not wanting to attain But we have this assumption that that's what it is. And so how do we, like, how do we support those folks that are still in that space and want to continue to be in that space and within our organizations? And then I think about just the show, Kathy, in regards, so maybe to like the, to nuance it out is like, who listens to podcasts, right? In this, like, and I would wonder even like, who listens to these, mm-hmm. right? And where's the value at? And so when we think about this work, who has access, who has knowledge around, who has time, and like that's classed spaces.
Well, and Becky, like you and I were talking about this, you know, earlier this week too, like journals, like academic journals. So yeah, like unless you're employed by the university or as a student paying for the university, you have to pay to get access to this knowledge, right? It's a way in which the knowledge is created, disseminated, but also commodified, you know? And in a lot of ways, things like podcasts, and this, these stratas of class, right? Like podcasts become open access spaces that knowledge can be shared. It's just like, it's, I can put on, if I'm able to, my headphones on the bus as I'm going somewhere, right? Things like Spotify that are free, Google, like there's ways in which this information is accessible, right? But then how do you know to find it, right? So it might be there, but like, how do I search for it? Does like, and so even just all those things, right? So I think it's so multi-layered around, you know, because we can call something accessible, but how accessible is it? You know, if it's just not within my realm to even know that it exists.
Right.
And so that for me brings up the responsibility of leaders across class of origin, but currently upper middle, if not upper class, to have dismantling classism a part of the strategic agenda in the same way that dismantling racism and creating true equity inclusion is. And I do wonder if seeing how the structural changes around dismantling racism and building up capacity to recognize and engage and might be useful. And my guess is there could be places on campus where folks and other organizations experience marginalization by class can gather that affinity space. What I wonder is, anybody ever heard of a privilege group? So like we do white accountability groups. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen an organization that is not doing this, or let us help you, but leaders, managers who are currently in class privileged positions doing your deep work so that you recognize how you perpetuate classism individually, as well as climate, culture, policies, practices, and then what we need to do collaboratively with everyone to change? Have you seen anything close to that?
I haven't seen it.
Because we're doing it with white folk. And that's a lot. So call to listeners. Could be a next step.
It could be. That would be interesting. Thanks, Kathy. I had never thought about that. I was like, how would I even run that? Like, what would be the structure? What would be the prompts? How do you create trust? How do you get out of shame and guilt? How do you give language? I know class action does work across class, but I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
It would be fun to pilot something.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Becky, like you had mentioned earlier this week too, like that you had been in a space that was more cross-class and the difficulty of holding that space. I don't know if you want to comment on that and like what that might be then to focus just on one group, one class group versus another.
Yeah. You know, I've been working with a campus that we did 5 sessions on class, and it was a variety of anybody from facilities to the titled director. Mm-hmm. And it is like, it was a struggle in that space, right? So when we talk about pay or access, we have folks with degrees that get paid well enough and have retirement and aren't laborers in the same physical way. And the, so I don't know, you're frozen on my end, but I'm going to continue talking.
You're good.
Okay. I think the folks where their class of origin and their current class was working class were like, we just want tangibles. We want to talk about it in more direct ways. And it's a hard space to hold because there has been it can be so very obvious in a hierarchical system, how it plays itself out. And so needing to work through, like giving language, but skills to be able to talk about it. I think it's just it's a hard one, right? Because it is the directly haves and have nots. And then there's the spectrum of what in that looks like and what that feels like and how that plays out and who has value and voice.
So then that has me thinking, right? Like on the organizational level, like how class shapes what I think I need for my organization. Like the needs of, you know, again, just different things. I would have to think about that more, right? How is what I feel like I need as an executive director, how is that different than what I thought I needed as an assistant director? What I thought I needed as a graduate intern, and how class may have been part of what I thought I just deserved in that role. You know, and the access that comes with those different positions. Because now I'm even thinking about the how I've negotiated job offers and job negotiations as I've moved up. Mm-hmm. And the conversations around what I should ask for or what I could ask for at those different levels. And that sets the precedence for then how should I be treated for the rest of the time in this role at the institution. Mm-hmm. You know, and all the coded and unwritten rules about job negotiations. But those really, again, those set the foundations for what I should expect for the rest of my time within this organization. Do I even get to negotiate for a job salary?
Yeah.
Or am I told I should just be happy that I got this much? Mm-hmm. Or that I'm happy that I just got a job?
Yeah. The word deserve. Oh, sorry. Go back.
No, I was going to say, we had Sanja on, Dr. Sanja Ardois. And she talked about that same thing, right? Like how do organizations make transparent salary and just be really upfront with it so that there's even not the need to have the skill to negotiate, but like how do we create a system where that isn't have to like be upfront, here's this, like not even salary range, but here's the salary because people may not be skilled to know that they can even do that.
Hadn't been coached.
Right.
So part of this class capital is who got coached, mentored, networked, encouraged, who's assumed we're going to have to negotiate by class privilege, often race privilege, white privilege, and then who is treated with dismissal of how dare you. The other thing that comes to me is I was thinking the word deserve, and you said it, Ale, about someone with very little class privilege access, I don't deserve much more. I wonder when people shift from, I don't deserve much to how dare you treat me that way? I deserve this. Mm-hmm. I deserve. And that sense of entitlement and I deserve more than I'm getting, I think is part of upper middle class elitist. Whew.
Yeah. Well, and to me, that goes back to the job negotiation piece because it's, at a certain point, it's not just my salary, it's my clothes, stipend, my car stipend, you know, will I get a rent-free house for the 6 months at this level? All those like elements of privilege. I mean, that's true privilege, right? Like not only are you gonna pay my salary, but you're also gonna give me a house as I'm in this position. And how that's different than as a resident director, and this is a very higher ed example, like we're paying for your room because you work here and you're going to live here and we need you to address crisis versus, no, we're just going to give you a house. near campus, right? And so the that looks different across the hierarchy. We're not offering that to everyone. And at a certain point, again, that entitlement kicks in of like, so wait, you don't have a house for me? Like, why would I even entertain this job offer? My last three positions gave me that, you know? And so like, to me, it's those elements that we really need to pay attention to. And that happens as you move up the hierarchy.
And you internalize it, right? Like there's all of this internalization. So Kathy, as I hear the, when do we switch from I'll take what I can get to I deserve? Like there's so much like generational internalization, oppression or privilege that takes so much deep work to unlearn. 'Cause I can even show up in that. Yeah, this is my fee. But I'm willing to negotiate and at least I get to do good work. And it's not as hard as where I have consultant colleagues who are like, nope, this is it for me. And my internal reaction is, are you serious? Yeah.
I know. I don't know if it's a real insight, but there's something about white privilege that all white people have across, it's different across class, but there's something about class privilege. I wonder that as you get into the senior leadership, it is so, so much privilege compared to a manager who's middle class. So new thought, I don't know, but it feels more individual that I'm going to hold on to what I got as opposed to maybe it's me that I just see how I benefit from dismantling racism as a white person. I mean, in my soul, I see how I benefit. I don't know yet how to convince people with current class privilege and or from growing up, what's in their self-interest to dismantle classism in the organization. Because that zero-sum game, if we really share resources equitably, that means leaders are going to be making less money and have less benefits. Maybe. It feels different somehow.
I think, and for me, particularly within a U.S. context, and I'm going to go heady because I'm a nerd, but like it's so wrapped up into capitalism, right? So the capitalist way we think, capitalism cuts across race differently. It cuts across gender. It's in some ways, systems of oppression are enacted through capitalism. Right, as we think about access to resources, opportunity, space, it's rooted in the way in which capitalism functions. So it's so much harder to understand how it may show up on the individual level. Again, it's the language piece that I think we really need again to figure out, because it is like it's again. I have been so deeply socialized to not undo the system of capitalism. I've been socialized to buy into it and be a consumer of it and learn how to commodify everything that I do so that I can get paid more. And that the way that I undo classism is by achieving a higher class, by achieving more access. Like to me, like that's like, as I've unpacked a lot, like that's been the message of how do you solve this for myself? Learning how to undo that, it's really complicated. But I think about the environmental impact of capitalism, the human impact of classism is so painful and detrimental to our like physical, emotional, spiritual health.
And of course, we have to close as people are hearing that. Will you come back?
Absolutely.
We could do so much more. Ale, we want to thank you for coming. In the last 20 seconds, can you tell people how they can find you? Because I think you're going to be getting some emails and phone calls, sir.
Yes, absolutely. You can reach me at coverubiusconsulting.com. My consulting is Foundations for Hope and Justice Consulting, and really hope that I get to come back and do some more conversation and continue to do good work in the world.
We hope today, as well as the other ones, have you inspired to recognize classism, to speak up more, to engage other people, to really create true equity in your organizations, family systems, Dr. Becky Martinez, Dr. Kathy Aubert, Transformation Change Radio. We will see you next month. Thank you all for joining.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Kathy Aubert on Transformation Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to catch us next time as Kathy inspires listeners to become agents of change, motivate, innovate, and speak truth to power. Step into the courageous you that will change the world. Connect to life-changing conversations to extend your reach. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyaubert.com. That's drkathyaubert.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.